Today's Teisho will be on case 85 in the Hikigan Proku, the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 85 is entitled The Master of Toho Hermitage Roars Like a Tiger. Engo's introduction. Controlling the world, he allows not the least speck of dust to escape. And all people on earth give up their weapons and still their tongues. This is the enforcement of the monk's ordinance. The beams from his forehead pierce in the four directions. This is an activity of the monk's diamond eye. He turns iron into gold and gold into iron, and both holds fast and lets go. This is the action of the monk's staff. He stops the mouths of all people under the sun, making them silent as if driven 3,000 miles away. This is the force of the monk's spirit. But what would you say when one falls short of these abilities? See the following. Main subject. A monk came to visit the master of Toho Hermitage and said to him, "If on this mountain you were suddenly to meet a tiger, what would you do?" The master roared like a tiger. The monk pretended to be frightened. The master roared with laughter. The monk said, "You old robber." The master said, "Try as you may, you cannot do anything to me." The monk stopped short. Secho says they were both veteran robbers, but they stopped their ears and tried to steal the bell. Secho's verse, a chance, and if you fail to seize it, you miss by 1,000 miles. The tiger had fine strikes, but no fangs and claws. Remember the battle on Mount Taiyu. Their words and actions shook the earth. If you have eyes to see, you see. They caught both head and tail of it. So thank you all very much for coming to practice Zen this morning. Driving here, I still come here to Rutgers to live stream the sits because the Wi-Fi here is so good. At my house, it's okay, but it's not always reliable. So I drive over here, and when I was driving over here this morning, I was just so, it was so beautiful, right? It's such a beautiful, beautiful early summer day, and I'm very glad you're here and you're able to practice Zen this morning. Thank you so much for coming. 2 weeks ago, we finished our wonderful sesshin, and that was an amazing experience. It really worked so well. I'm still kind of in awe of what happened, but everybody working together made this possible. You know, in Buddhism, there are three jewels. The Buddha, the Dharma, his teaching, and the Sangha, the community of practitioners. And everybody who came to that sesshin and everybody here today is making this practice possible. And I thank you so much. I could see everybody on the screen sitting this morning with great dedication. And I thank you so much for being here. So, This is a wonderful koan for our time, right? This is a really great koan for our time. The master of Toho Hermitage roars like a tiger. You know, I was asked a couple months ago to give a talk on Zen practice in these difficult times. By Tricycle Magazine. Some of you know that I write for Tricycle Magazine, and it's really a pleasure to do that. I love working with them. They're really wonderful people. And They asked me to make a, you know, to do a video, and they put it on Facebook, and they had a whole series of these. But I don't necessarily think my talk went over that well. It was about an hour and 20 minutes. It was a workshop, really, a meditation workshop. But there was a talk, and then there were some activities, meditation-related activities. And at the end, there was a question and answer period, so people could write things in the comments section, and the moderator would read them and ask me the questions. And he asked me a question. Somebody said something about, why are you bringing in politics to this, right? Why are you bringing in politics? And he noted that during the presentation, a number of people, probably a number of people had exited already, because there were a number of comments like, why did you have to bring Trump into this? Why did you have to bring politics into this? And he asked me a question based on one of the comments that was something to that effect. You know, that was an interesting thing to me, because, you know, I think it made me realize that when many people think about meditation, they think about meditation as mental calming, you know, mental calming. And many people think about meditation as like a finding a calm place, a calm space in a turbulent world. Some place where you can center, you can close the door, center yourself, and be at peace. And it bothered those people, I think, that I, you know, they were coming and expecting me to give them instructions about how to get to that place. And instead, what I did, one of the first things I did was to talk about Donald Trump. And it upset them, because that's the very thing that was making them agitated and fearful. And I do worry that a lot of people understand meditation practice as mental calming, or a quest for serenity, or a quest for peace, right? Peace. And I do think peace is really important, and I really do think serenity is important. But, you know, we in Chan, we in Zen believe that if you cling to any state of mind, that becomes an obstacle. It becomes an obstacle. Even states of mind like, you know, tranquility, or states of mind like samadhi, even samadhi, which is so essential to our practice. So anyway, I wasn't sure how to deal with that question about politics. It surprised me so much. I mean, it was so much in the background. But, you know, I see now that there's probably this misunderstanding about Zen. It's definitely the case that when you begin to practice Zen, you need to be able to enter a quiet state of mind. You know, it's definitely the case. You need to quiet the mind, and you need to stop thinking. So if you are agitated and you're thinking about, say, Black Lives Matter, or the president, or COVID-19, and it's causing you constant anxiety, right? You do need to sit down on the cushion and watch your breath. And even before any of these events, you know, people have all kinds of things that produce stress, often job-related, family issues. You know, somebody was talking to me about how difficult it is. He's taking care of both of his parents, and how difficult it is to do that, and how it creates a lot of tension for him. And I know that this is often the case. So, you know, work-related, family-related issues, you know, at some point we just find there's no escape. And it's really valuable to be able to sit down on the cushion and learn how to move away from your thoughts. And it's a real revelation. You know, the first time that happens, I know that when I started going to the Seattle Zen Center, you know, I would sit on the cushion, and without even knowing it, I would get to this place where suddenly it was spacious and serene. And my thoughts weren't completely gone, but they were just drifting by on the margins of my attention. And my mind was just serene, and it felt so good. It felt like such a relief, because I too, you know, started sitting because I was being driven crazy by my inner narratives and my self-doubts and all of this stress on me. And when I would go to the Zen Center and sit, it would take me about one sit just to sort of peel myself off the ceiling. You know, I was usually pretty tense. And then the second sit, we would sit and then we would do some walking meditation, like on a Monday night in our Sangha. And then we'd sit down again, and that second sit, it was just like, oh. Sometimes I would even drop off to sleep almost, because it's just such a relief not to have that pressure. And, you know, at first we identify with our thoughts, we identify with our emotions, we identify with our perceptions. And, you know, there's a thought, there's a perception, there's an emotion, there's a thought, there's a perception, or I should say there's a perception, there's a thought, there's an emotion, there's a perception, there's a thought, there's an emotion. And this goes on, and we identify with them as ours. And by the way, this goes back to the earliest Buddhist teaching. If you read the Pali Sutras, the Buddha says, he actually says, none of those things belong to you. They're just happening. And he says, you know, the thoughts you are having, the sounds you are hearing, the emotions you feel, none of these are actually yours. They're just things that are happening to you. And he actually says, they are produced by cause and effect. They're produced by cause and effect. And if you think about it, there's a lot of truth to that, right? I mean, so for example, if you see a movie, and then the next day tonight, you go to HBO or Netflix, and you watch a movie, and tomorrow you come to sit on Sunday morning, we have our Sunday morning sit, you sit down and suddenly there's the movie in your head, and if you're not careful, you can sort of replay the whole movie, and you can say, you know, I'd like to get away from this movie, but how did it get there? You know, when you sat down on the cushion, you didn't choose to say, let's replay the movie. You know, it just pops up. And in fact, you know, you don't really choose any of your thoughts. If you think about it, you don't choose them. They just arise, you know. So, you know, even if you say, whatever I'm doing today, I'm not going to think of Mr. Trump, right? You know, you sit down, you're doing something, and all of a sudden, there's Trump in all his glory, right? And it's like, why is that happening? The Buddha said, look, your mental processing has its own interior laws, right? Your mind produces thoughts following its own laws of cause and effect. And actually, your sensations work the same way. You know, we don't choose to have a sensation. We just have a sensation. And the sensation is also caused, he says, the Buddha says, by cause and effect. So actually, a lot of early meditation practice is realizing that is ceasing to identify with our perceptions, our mental activity, and our emotions, right? And you know, it happens to everybody who practices. If you do enough meditation, one day you come in, you sit down on the cushion, and all of a sudden, it's like your thoughts are on the margin, or your perceptions are on the margin, or your emotions are on the margin, and there's like an empty space that opens up, this spaciousness, and it's like thought goes by, and a thought goes by, and a thought goes by, and this empty space opens up. This is Lan Tian. This is the blue sky of the mind, right? Now, getting to this place is a real achievement because people identify with their thoughts. And when you can get to the Lantian, the blue sky, that spacious mind, and you stop identifying with your thoughts, you've accomplished something really major. And that's a kind of liberation. It's really a liberation to cease to identify with your thoughts. It's we think of things, even memories, really aren't ours. They're just being produced by these mental processes, that we don't control and we don't choose. You don't choose. You may ask yourself sometime, what did my house look like on Bird's Eye Lane in Bowie, Maryland, when I was a kid, right? You might, but generally speaking, things just pop into your head. You're mowing the lawn and suddenly you remember the color of the cat you had when you were a little kid, right? It's like, why is that there? You didn't choose it. You don't control it. It's not yours, actually. It's no more yours than the wind going by or, a bird singing. Right? We identify, but it's, and so learning how not to identify, to get to that spacious place is so wonderful and it's so liberating. And often when you get into that place, it feels like your mind is stable and grounded, or you feel like you're planted solid, you're at an immovable place. Say you're in an immovable place. And this is so valuable. Getting to this immovable place is so liberating, and it's such a relief to know that there's this imperturbable place. And often, being able to get to that imperturbable place is accompanied by a kind of bliss that eventually, if you just keep sitting, you get into that imperturbable place, that Lantian, that Aozu. Aozu, the blue sky. You get into that place and it just feels wonderful. And then it's like, actually, what happens is when you can do that, you release all of this energy that's trapped by your tension and your blocking. So actually, human beings have a lot of energy. We have a huge amount of energy. And if you keep doing zazen, you will get into that energy much more easily and clearly than normally people are stressed and clenched. You could say clenched, like a clenched fist. People are holding themselves, they feel like they're holding themselves together, or it's like they're in a defensive posture. It's like all the time. And because they're ready to ward off blows, or they're expecting the worst, they're expending tremendous energy on, basically locking down the system. When you can get to that place, that blue sky mind, and you begin to stop identifying with your thoughts, you'll notice that at first you feel better. But then eventually there's a lot of energy. It's like, I remember at a certain phase in my practice, sitting down on the cushion and just feeling like, wow, I feel like a bomb is going off in my body. It was just this wonderful surge of energy in the morning when I would sit. And it's like, where does that come from? That's always there. That's always there. Our attachments and fears create blockages. And when we begin to take those blockages away, you have a lot more energy on the cushion. So as this process is going on, of learning how to get to the empty sky mind, you're also starting to release a lot of energy. It's like the dam has broken and now the energy is flowing freely. And when the energy is flowing freely, it's blissful. It's like this beautiful, blissful feeling. And so that stage of meditation is really marvelous. It's delicious. It's wonderful. And it never goes away. You can get there, if you practice regularly, you can get there quite often. you know, it might not always have the same blissful character or the same explosive energy character, but you can get to that place very often where you feel renewed or you feel 30 years younger, you know, that kind of thing. But if you stay there, you become a prisoner of that state of consciousness too. So one way to tell if you're addicted to samadhi or addicted to bliss is to notice your reaction when it goes away. You know, so this used to happen to me. You know, I would sit at the Zen Center in Seattle, which was in South Seattle. And then I would also sit at my home. And I would go to graduate school in the morning, and it was very stressful. I had to do a lot of preparation. I remember I had this professor who didn't mean to be not a nice guy, but he was just not a nice guy. He was one of the foremost people in modern studies, modern literature. And I remember this woman whose name was Laurie. Laurie and I both had to give presentations on poems. And I was giving a presentation on a poem by a wonderful Irish poet named William Butler Yeats. And so was Laurie. So we were on the same day together. And she had done all of this research, and she started presenting the research, and his name was Hazard Adams. He's not into Zen, so he'll never know I took his name in vain. But Hazard Adams cut her off and said, "That is a good example of use." She was citing all this scholarship, and he said, "That is a good example of really useless scholarship." And I saw her face just turn absolutely bright red. He just eviscerated her. And then he realized what he did, and he said, "I'm not really talking about you, I'm talking about the scholars you're talking about." But it was really too late. It was so awful. And then I had to give my presentation. It's like, oh my, he's going to, you know, I'm going to be eviscerated, right? You know. And I was skating on thin ice anyway. I hadn't done nearly the homework that she had done. And so anyway, that was a kind of a day that I would have. And then I would come home, and it was like I was just running for the cushion. Like, let me at that cushion and sit down on the cushion and get into deep samadhi, right? And it's like, oh, you know, get into that open space. It is so beautiful, so beautiful. And then, you know, then there would be these, I've mentioned before that when I was living in this place, there were two Iranian guys in the basement who would have their TV on at all hours of the day, blaring, right? And then there would be that TV. It would be some quiz show. It would be like, you know, The Price is Right or something. And I'm trying to focus, and I would get so mad. I would go down and knock on the door, and I wouldn't threaten them or something, but I would say, "Would you please turn that down?" You know, and nobody would answer the door, right? And, you know, because it was too loud, they couldn't hear me knock on the door. It was just like, ah. So, you know, you're not a Buddha at that stage, right? I mean, that's not something the Buddha would do, right? If I could have broken the door down, I would have broken the door down, because they had taken away my beautiful, clear mind, right? My beautiful, blissful mind. And I understand, you know, we are living in such stressful and difficult times, right? That I can understand why people want to run for the cushion and sit down and just chill out, right? You know? I mean, it's actually the case that a couple months ago, within a couple weeks at the beginning of the pandemic, at the beginning of the quarantine, two people I knew died within a couple of weeks. And I think a lot of people were wondering, am I going to be around in 5 months, you know? And I going to the store was like, you know, and a little bit unnerving. So I can understand, you know, why people were stressed. You know, it's very, you might, even if you don't take a threat seriously, you know it's there, and it begins to drain away that energy. So I can understand why people were were responding to my talk that way. They were looking to get from meditation practice what I had gotten from meditation practice, finding that lan tian, the ao zou mentality, right? The blue sky mind, which is so precious and so beautiful. But if we stay there, we are not, that is not enlightenment. In some traditions, people actually think entering that blissful state is enlightenment. You're communing with, the Atman or something like that. You're communing with the eternal self. But we in Buddhism don't believe that. We think that's just another state. It's a precious, liberating, wonderful thing, but it's just another state of mind. And if you cling to it, you become a prisoner. You can't. You're making discriminations all over again, right? I mean, part of meditation practice is learning just to be present in the moment, watching the breath. We say choiceless awareness, but when you begin to cling to samadhi, it's no longer choiceless awareness, right? It's become your refuge in the chaos. But that creates a huge split between yourself and the world. See? Now you're more removed from the world than ever. Now you're more isolated and cut off than ever, actually. And if you continue to seek samadhi in that way, your practice gets worse and worse. I've mentioned this before, but there was a guy who was coming to our meditation, to our sangha for a couple of years. I heard, and then he was a regular for a while, and then a new person came. And the new person had been coming for a couple of weeks, and I heard them talking on the other side of the partition where people leave their shoes. And the new guy said to the other person, he said, "Wow, this is just wonderful. This feels so great." And the guy who'd been coming for a couple of years said, "Oh, it's like that at first, but then that goes away and you're back where you were," right? And I didn't say anything because what can I say? But it's clear that the person who had been there longer had been clinging to the samadhi experience, and gradually his open sky became crowded with his own attachments and desires all over again, his own fears and expectations all over again. So, a lot of the work of Zen practice is constantly going back to emptiness, wuxin. And no matter what comes out on the other end of that, we have to deal with it. Living in difficult times is really the best thing for practice, right? The best thing for practice. Because if you stop clinging to your bliss and you go into do machine, and then things in your life begin to intrude, this forces you to develop a more spacious mind, a more spacious mind, a more resilient kind of samadhi. There's a kind of samadhi which clings to stillness, but there's actually a kind of samadhi that doesn't cling to anything. In Zen, it said the nowhere dwelling mind. So, I remember that this happening to me in Seattle. At one time, I used to take a bus to the Zen Center, and I would go twice a day for a while. I was actually for a couple of years, I was going twice a day. So I'd get up, catch the bus, go up to Capitol Hill, if you know Seattle, sit at the Zen Center, go down, teach my courses, take my courses. At the end of the day, I'd go up, and I remember coming down after the morning sit and being on the bus and just realizing that I was in deep samadhi. That feeling of being grounded or centered. And I, people were getting on and off the bus, You know, the bus was roaring, cars were honking. And I just realized, you know, right now I'm in the same deep samadhi I was an hour ago on the cushion. You know, it's like you carry it with you. You carry it with you. And it didn't last the whole day, but it definitely lasted the whole trip. And that's when I began to realize, you know, that there's a deeper samadhi than just clinging to that stillness. And so, you know, practice in a way involves challenging yourself, really. You know, basically stepping out of your stillness or leaving the zendo and going out into the street, literally in this case. And you begin to notice that it's possible to maintain that mental stability, that mental stabilization, even in the midst of things being chaotic. You don't have to really even try to make this happen. If you just keep sitting, you know, it's going to happen automatically. And koans are a way of helping this to happen and deepening this experience. You know, koans often involve working with something that upsets people. You know, the great Japanese Zen master Hakuin Zenji once referred to the koans as he said those vile koans, vile. And what he meant was, you know, the koans force us to deal with things that we don't want to deal with, the things that are outside the circle of our calm and composure. Basically there's a koan that goes like this, Ukyu's unfair blows. And it's about getting unfair blows, right? Being unfairly treated. You know, we've all been unfairly treated. You know, at some point in our life, we might not have been on the receiving end of physical blows, but I haven't met anybody in, I have not had the good fortune of meeting anybody who hasn't had some kind of an injustice done to her or some kind of an injustice done to him. And so, you know, when you begin to sit with, you go into samadhi and you sit with Ukyu's unfair blows and you say unfair blows, right? You know, pretty soon your beautiful blue sky mind is gone. And you find yourself experiencing maybe memories of something that happened to you in childhood. You know, when I was working with this koan, I had a number of different responses. And for a while, I lived in Baltimore. And if you know anything about Baltimore, it wasn't, probably still is, a very tough place to live. And I used to go to a school which still exists. It's called York Elementary School off of Lock Raven Boulevard in Baltimore. And I lived in an apartment complex, and I would have to walk to school. I never knew when I would walk to school if I was going to be the target of violence or not, you know? And, you know, there was a bully culture at the school, and there was a bully culture on the way to the school. And sometimes people would beat me up. It was like, I have to go to school, but I might get beaten up, you know. And coming home was like, I might get beaten up. And we had like a little brigade. I had a friend, Mark Miller, and another friend, Freddie was his name. I can't remember his last name. But we would walk home together just to, you know, avoid getting beaten up. And when I was working with the Ukyu's unfair blows koan, you know, all of a sudden there it was, you know, that was a terrible time in my life. You know, I was just a little kid and I would try to tell my parents, you know, these kids would beat me up. And my father would say, you just have to hit him right back. It's like, but he's a foot taller than I am, right? You know, and so it came back on the cushion, all that sense of powerlessness. You know, fear. I would be so afraid, you know. I carried that with me all my life, really. And so, you know, confronting that, sitting with that, makes your equanimity, your mental composure just fly out the window. And you're sitting on the cushion and you feel you know, those kids are going to come and beat me up at any minute, right? And that's really, that's really a sickening feeling, right? Knowing you're just about to be, real suffering is about to be inflicted on you and there's nothing you can do about it. And to be back in that place is an unpleasant experience. But then, you know, you're there for a while and you suddenly realize that even in this place, even in the middle of this hell realm, there's a kind of stillness or calm. And when you discover that, it's really like a liberation. It's a liberation in itself, you know, to be back in that place emotionally, you know, which actually would cause me a lot of anxiety even as an adult. You know, similar situations would produce responses that were that feeling of being trapped, about to be punished, you know, that sense of helplessness, you know, and suddenly, you know, I remember working with this koan and having this sense of suddenly there's a stillness right in the middle of this, you know, right in the middle of all of this, there was a stillness. I didn't notice it as a kid, but it was there. And when you can, you know, when you discover that, you realize I can access this right now. It's right here. And then, of course, there's this tremendous energy. You know, I think this is something we learn in Zen practice. We learn in koan practice again and again. You know, you get into a place where you think there's no hope, you're totally trapped, you feel powerless, all of these things that produce these panicky reactions or angry reactions. And, you know, when you work with a koan, you suddenly realize there's this openness or this clearing. It's like clouds clearing. You know, there's this clearing, this imperturbable stillness right in the middle of all this hell. All this hell. But, you know, the way to find that stillness, that imperturbable stillness, is not to run away from hell, but to go into hell. That sounds crazy, I know. But actually, you know, that's the method. You know, the thing that bothers you, the thing that you're afraid of, is the door into awakening. The thing that you fear is the door into awakening. And most of us have a lot of things we fear, so luckily there's a lot of doors, but you keep going to the thing that frightens you or the thing that you don't want to deal with. And you have to deal with it in your Zen practice, and you discover, you know, actually that right in the middle of this, in the heart of this samsara, there is nirvana. There's this amazing spaciousness, this amazing openness of openness. So, you know, really the art of doing Zen is not about stillness. Yes, you have to find the stillness, but then, you know, it's almost as though we're using our, is this saying, there's a couple sayings. You know, a monk once said to Master Joshu, the great Zen Master Joshu, he said, I understand that a teacher, a monk who encourages his students to break the precepts, the Buddhist monk's vows, goes straight to hell. That was the question he asked Master Joshu. And Joshu said, well, you know, sign me up. I'll be the first to go, basically. I'll be the first to go to hell. In other words, you know, I'm not afraid to make mistakes and go to hell. Mistakes send you to hell sometimes, right? I'm not afraid to make mistakes and go to hell. Because, you know, in hell, I can discover, I can deepen my understanding or my awareness of Buddha mind, the Buddha mind which is present everywhere. The Buddha mind which is present everywhere. Every occasion, in every situation, if you know, we get pretty good at finding it in Zen, and it's always there, it just takes a little looking. See, interestingly, this koan is really beautifully structured because it starts out saying something that is designed to make you feel far from enlightenment, okay? So Engo says at the beginning, controlling, this is the man of Zen, the woman of Zen, he says, controlling the world, he allows not the least speck of dust to escape. And all people on earth give up their weapons and still their tongues in his presence. This is the enforcement of the monk's ordinance. Beams of light from his forehead pierce in the four directions. This is the activity of the monk's diamond eye. He turns iron into gold and gold into iron. He holds fast and lets go. This is the action of the monk's staff. He stops the mouths of all people under the sun, making them silent, as if driven 3,000 miles away. This is the force of the monk's spirit. What would you say when one falls short of these abilities? Well, if you listen to that and you compare it to yourself, you think, well, I'm screwed. You know, I can't do any of these. I've been practicing Zen for 40 years and I can't do any of these things. You know, what? You know, I'm really low on the totem pole, right? You know, he's saying basically, you know, we would like to be always on top of things. Right, and we imagine the person of Zen to be always on top of every occasion. But nobody's always on top of every challenge, right? We all get knocked down. We all get thrown off balance, right? We're thrown off balance, you know. And that's when we can deepen our understanding or our experience, I should say, of Buddha mind. Those are the occasions that really make it possible to wake up, to wake up. You know, even the Buddha had bad days. You know, if you read the Mahayana Sutras, the Buddha, you know, there's beams of light coming out of his head, he claps his hands and universes spring up. But, you know, if you read the early Pali Sutras, the Buddha had, you know, the Buddha's family were wiped out in a genocide. There were famines. The Pali Sutras record famines where people the Buddha knew actually died. You know, the Buddha's was constantly, you know, I didn't say this at the tricycle question and answer, but the Buddha was very much involved in politics in his day. He was consulted all the time by political leaders, and in fact, I've mentioned this before, the Buddha belonged to a country which was like a democracy, actually. It was called the Shakya Republic. It was a republic, and they had a House of Parliament. And they invited the Buddha to come to the House of Parliament to give a speech when it was rebuilt, and they wanted to rededicate the Parliament. They invited the world-honored one, and the Buddha came and gave a speech. And all of that went down the tubes in his lifetime. You know, we don't have any records of the Buddha crying, but we definitely know, you know, it's definitely the case that the Buddha was challenged by very difficult situations. And he couldn't make them just go away, right? I mean, he tried to save his people. There was a military power on the border of his country called Kosala. And the Kosala invaded the Shakya Republic three times, and twice the Buddha was able to intercept the army and just convince them not to attack. But he was away on the third try, and they came in, the sutras say, and wiped out the Shakya Republic. So, you know, those are challenging situations. He didn't just clap his hands and the army disappeared, right? He must have had stressful moments. But, you know, anything, those moments are what makes it possible to wake up. Those moments are what makes it possible to wake up. I can tell you so many stories of people I know who had their great awakening experience under terrible conditions. You know, either they were physically ill or somebody they know had just died, or there was chaos in the temple and everything was falling apart. You know, those are the moments when it's possible to discover in the midst of all this chaos, this imperturbable luminosity, this radiant stillness, right? This, I can't describe it, but Buddha mind, we say. So, you know, if you, nobody likes to be knocked off balance, right? But if it happens to you enough and you come through on the other side, you know, you have a different attitude. You have a different attitude. You know, it's like right now, so many things are going wrong, right? I mean, you could just list, you know, every day if you do read the newspaper, it's like, you know, Trump will suspend all environmental regulations, or really, it's like, you know, it's just like, go ahead, you know, set the world on fire. It could, you know, in certain ways, it could be worse, but it's pretty bad. You know, but this is, times like this are possible. Now there's a possibility of transformation for our whole society. You know, I think it's kind of a miracle that there have been all these demonstrations. And our society, you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, I was reading, they said 2 years ago, when people did surveys of American public opinion of Black Lives Matter, they were looked at very suspiciously. And now, like, 75% of Americans have a very favorable view of them. And people are suddenly talking about all this discrimination, you know, about a history of discrimination and oppression and the need for change. And all of this was scary and unpleasant, but look at what's coming out of it. You know, as a society, we might come out on the other end of this so much better than when we went in. And so, you know, it's true for societies, but it's also true for people. You know, I mean, we're talking about millions of people, but somehow in the midst of all this chaos, all this suffering and disorder, we have found a kind of radiance, right, in ourselves. We found a kind of spaciousness and generosity and compassion in ourselves. And people are discovering that. You know, they might not use those words to describe it, but it's sort of spontaneously breaking out. And it's not the end of our problems, and it's not the end of the people who are causing our problems. So far as I know, Trump has not changed since last night. But something's happening to people. You know, they're discovering that in the middle of all this darkness, there's this radiance. You know, and we're seeing it. I think it's a mixed picture. It's never settled. You know, you work through one obstacle and there's another obstacle, but you're setting free that Buddha nature in yourself. You're accessing that Buddha nature in yourself. And the more you do that, the less afraid we are, right? The less afraid we are, and the more receptive we are to the possibilities. So, you know, a monk came to the master of Toho Hermitage and said to him, "If on this mountain you were suddenly to meet a tiger, what would you do?" You know, one answer is I would sit right down and go into deep samadhi, which is not a bad answer. One answer is I would run away screaming, right? I'd run away screaming. One answer is, well, I wouldn't run away screaming. I'd sit down on the cushion and I'd enter deep samadhi. But the master said I'd roar like a tiger. See, I would embrace hell. I'd go straight to hell. I'd go straight into hell. I'd go straight into hell. The master roared like a tiger. The monk pretended to be frightened. The master roared with laughter. The monk said, "You old robber," in other words, "you're a very accomplished person, you know." And the master said, "Try as you may, you cannot do anything to me." In other words, there's always this imperturbable radiance in us, right? It's always there, always there. The monk stopped short. He just he returns to the imperturbable radiance. Setro says they were both veteran robbers. They stopped their ears and tried to steal the bell. In other words, they both understand this very well. Setro's verse, a chance, and if you fail to seize it, you miss by 1,000 miles. Okay, that's designed to create anxiety, right? In other words, that's not true. If you miss it, you have another chance. Infinite chances, right? A chance, and if you fail to seize it, you miss by 1,000 miles. No. We all get knocked down. We all make bad decisions. That's the way it is, right? So there's always a chance. There's always another chance. There's always another sit, and there'll be the chance to work through our obstacles. And if we don't get it this time, we'll get it next time. The tiger had fine stripes, but no fangs and claws. Remember the battle on Mount Taiyu. Their words and actions shook the earth. If you have eyes to see, you see. They caught the head and tail of it.